Can I canoe you up the river? Can I canoe you up the stream? Can I canoe you up the river like I did in last night's dream?
A little music to get us started here as we talk canoeing and kayaking. You know, in December and January and February, it's pretty tough to canoe and kayak here in Wisconsin. Unless you want to do it on top of ice most of the time. But spring is here, and spring paddling is on our minds as we talk about canoeing and kayaking with a couple of experts. Darren Bush, one of them, owner and chief paddling evangelist for Rutabaga Paddle Sports in Madison. Darren, good to have you back.
Great to be here. Thank you.
With us as well, Timothy Bauer, author of the 2016 guidebook, Canoeing and Kayaking in Southern and South Central Wisconsin, 60 Paddling Adventures Within 60 Miles of Madison. It has a forthcoming guidebook covering the Driftless area.
That's right. Hi, Larry.
Coming up. Hi, Timothy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Darren.
Hello, Timothy.
And hello, everyone outside.
trying to sound like Norman Gilliland.
You know, it's hard. He's got that voice.
He's got that gravelly voice.
He's got the voice.
And sometimes he's in the studio right next to us, right. But I don't see him in there now. Well, let's talk about paddling, and maybe you're ready to dip a paddle in your favorite lake or stream. And I hope you will give us a call. Maybe you've got a lake or stream you want to talk about. Maybe you've got a question about canoeing or kayaking equipment. Maybe an experience to share. You can call us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Darren, how eager should we be to get out paddling this time of the year on our lakes and streams?
Well, it's kind of hard not to be. I'm actually going on Saturday. I'm going to head up and paddle up in the Driftless. I'm going to paddle the Kickapoo, and then possibly Coon Valley has a little stream in it, so I might hit that one too. But it's our 41st wedding anniversary, and my wife wanted to go paddling this weekend. So,
what a great way to celebrate the anniversary. Yeah.
I'm married up.
And Timothy, for you?
I try to get out as often as I can. There certainly is a palpable spring fever that takes hold this time of year. But there are some prospects, even during the cold months that you laid out, where sometimes you might be breaking through ice. But at least down here in South Central Wisconsin, there are a few select streams that if you choose carefully and you're mindful about the time you're out there, you could find some open water.
Yeah. And Darren, I know you've often said that the most dangerous day to paddle is the first day we hit 75 degrees.
Right. And that's because a lot of people who get in trouble, especially in the smaller sort of recreational kayaks that they pick up at the, you know, Farm and Fleet or whatever, hey, it's a beautiful day, let's go for a paddle in the, you know, 70 degrees, sunny and beautiful, but the water's still like 45. Mm-hmm. And then you get out there and you get flipped over and you get in trouble and you get this thing called cold water immersion shock, where you feel like you can't breathe. And if you're mindful, you can paddle. If you dress for immersion, you can paddle. It's just it's what you don't know that you don't know that gets you in trouble.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You need to be dressed properly, and you need to be wearing a flotation device. Let's call it a life vest.
Personal flotation device, whatever you call it.
Were they ever jackets?
Life jackets?
Yeah. I mean, they're often still called that, but I've yet to see one with sleeves.
No, they were. There was that Sportsman company years ago that made, they called it the float coat, and it looked like a regular jacket, but it was a PFD, and mostly for duck hunters and such. Uh-huh. But yeah, I've never heard of anybody, very few people get in trouble when they have a life jacket on. There's just a death up by the Dells, mm-hmm. Where a fishing boat turned over and they didn't have life jackets on. They were right there ready for them to grab, but in that situation, you don't really have the, you know, the situational awareness to grab it and put it on because you're dealing with 40 degree water.
Yeah. And it was really high, too.
Yeah,
it was all that turbulence below the dam kicks up very aerated water that is, you really can't manage your way through it. It's different because of all the oxygen.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Let's be careful out there, right?
Tim, many paddling guidebooks older than yours say the ideal time to paddle is mid-April to early June. Is that advice still valid, do you think?
That's a good question. Those guidebooks certainly had the right intention, and it was relevant at the time, usually referring to whitewater rivers, or at least rivers with a steep enough gradient that you're going to frequent class 2, 3, 4 rapids. So big waves. And all that water volume plus the gradient doesn't stay around for a long time. So they would map out on the calendar kind of like between mid-March or April to about like Memorial Day or so, when the ice finally melted and the snow melt. And you still have that for some rivers up north. You know, sometimes northern Wisconsin and southern Wisconsin feel like two distinctly different states. Down here, you know, the last two winters, we have had very little snow. Last year, we had snow on the ground for about 2 weeks, and then it was gone. And this year, we had like 5 or 7 inches for a few days, and that's about it. So we don't have snow melt. We have these periodic, episodic, intense thunderstorms that can bring 2 to 4 inches of rain, you know, in a 24-hour period. And so you have these sudden flashes of our rivers down here. But if you give them enough time, sometimes as little as 2 or 3 days, they come right back down. It's just you don't want to be on it right then and there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm the Kickapoo. I'm watching water levels up there right now because you want it to be between like 200 and 300 cubic feet per second. That's kind of the level. Above that, it gets kind of muddy and pushy. I don't mind that in my boats with my gear, but most people shouldn't do that. And then down below 100, 125, you start just to scrape the bottom all the time. So each river has its own little window, and Tim's guidebooks actually have that window in them. So it's super useful.
And I know last week, I think it was the Black and the Yellow Rivers in Jackson and Wood counties were reported at flood stage.
Yeah.
Yep.
You don't want to be out there then.
Still that way now, I think. And again, they'll come down. The Black itself is one of my favorite rivers, so I keep my own little attention and vigil to it. And it's already half the volume it was 48 hours ago. So they do come down about as quickly as they do go up. But there's still that window of time you want to stay off of it.
One of my favorites is the Grant, which is down south of Lancaster and runs into the Mississippi at Potosi. I call it like the baby Kickapoo. Mm-hmm. It's got some similar bluffs, but I don't see anybody on it. But it drains 800 square miles, which sounds like a lot, but it's not, right? Mm-hmm. So they'll get a thunderstorm, and it'll pop up 6 feet, and then it'll go right back down again within 12, 13 hours. So if you paddle these little rivers and look up into the trees and the fences, you'll see corn, like corn stalks and stuff bent around these fences. And it's like, well, how did they get up there? I said, well, they did in about 2 hours, and then down again. So the smaller the drainage area, the more likely you are to see large fluctuations when they get hit.
And for knowing that, what's the best way? You were right on top of things, Timothy, I think, too. Well, probably Darren as well. But
so there are two online gauges, I think, that we typically look at. One is through NOAA, N-O-A-A, and the other is through the USGS. Geological services. Each shows you a map. So there's a Wisconsin version for both of those websites. You could also look up neighboring states, etc. And for the USGS site, the state is kind of punctuated with colored dots, and each dot represents a gauge on a certain river. Unfortunately, we don't have gauges for every single stream in Wisconsin. Sure. That'd be a lot of dots. And the other really nuancy thing that's important to keep in mind is that the dots are colored, and they range from black, meaning very high, to red, meaning very low. Green is usually like the median color. Green
it's
does not
25 to 75% yeah. of normal, something like that.
Right. Yeah. So what green? The dots don't necessarily mean like too high or too low or just right. It's not a Goldilocks thing. What the dots, the colors indicate what the historical average is for that time of year. So the day you're looking at it, if we looked it up today, April 23rd, you'd see a lot of blue and black dots because it's spring and that's normal for the rivers to be high. It doesn't mean, again, that it's not that they're too high. It just means that they're higher for what their average is for this time of year. That's all very wonky stuff. On the milespaddle.com website, we have a whole special feature that we spent a fair amount of time coming up with called How to Gauge Wisconsin Water Levels. Whatever search engine is your choice, if you just put all that in or just go to milespaddle.com in our search engine, How to Gauge Wisconsin Water Levels, there's a whole step-by-step feature about how to find the two sites, how to interpret the data. But if you're ever in doubt, ask someone. Ask a local, make a phone call to a paddling shop, to a fishing place. Sometimes even a bar or restaurant that's on the river, they're going to know firsthand knowledge, you know, if it's high, if it's low, if it's dangerous, what the score is. You know, and as Darren, I've heard say, when in doubt, don't. I mean, let that be the bottom line. If you're feeling twitchy and uncomfortable in whatever category, it's not worth it.
We've already gotten some requests for, and you mentioned where you're going for your wedding anniversary, but we want to know where are you two paddling this spring, or where do you recommend?
Well, any place that is wet, right? So I'll be on the Kickapoo, I'll be on the Grant, I'll be on, I mean, the Pecatonica, the east branch of the Pecatonica, everybody's like, oh, man, how can that be? It's like, you know what? It's a muddy little farm ditch. But it's my muddy little farm ditch, and I love it, right? Mm-hmm. I was on the Sugar 2 weeks ago with a photographer doing some drone shooting, which was really fun. So I'm going to the Boundary Waters. I'm going to do some longer trips. I'm going to Vilas County. But I always say, you know, saving your vacation for 1 week so you can go on a big trip is kind of like eating once a year, right? Mm-hmm. So I kind of graze and paddle stuff within half an hour of Madison. So I'll do the Wisconsin I haven't been on the Turtle before, and mm-hmm. I haven't been on the Bark before, and those are two on my list, and they're in Tim's book. Mm-hmm. So those are on the list.
Tim?
My favorite place to go is where I haven't been yet. But there are places like the Driftless in particular in springtime, and again in autumn, but there's something I think synonymous almost with the Driftless area in springtime. The real trick with that is without leaves coming out yet, you can really see the rock outcroppings along the bluffs that the Driftless, you know, is abound with. It will seem kind of fickle, but there are certain streams I've been on the end of April, or let's say mid-April, and then return to 3 weeks later, and it's a night and day difference. As soon as that wall of leafy green comes out, it's like, you know, the bluffs are there, but it's as though they've just all been camouflaged or, you know, been hidden behind the curtains. So there is a sweet little ephemeral window in springtime that I really holds dear for me for the Driftless area. But again, there's that call of whitewater, you know, in the northern half of the state when things really open up before they get drought ridden and too shallow and scrapey, which could start as early as June.
This weekend is Pesh Fest on the Peshtigo River up north, which is probably the largest whitewater gathering in Wisconsin. And it's the perfect time to do it. But I like to use the word ephemeral because one of the things I love about the Kickapoo this time of year is you can see all the spring ephemerals that are blooming along the shore because the trees haven't filled up yet in the understory. and Tim's going to help me. What's the name of that creek that runs in the Kickapoo just above Bridge 10?
Give me a second. Yeah, this is, always works well for radio.
yeah, take your time. I forgot. The water should be up enough for me to paddle that.
Yeah, it's spring fed, so I think you should
south of Wildcat.
Yeah, no, I know exactly where it is. It's right by the ice cave. I'm just blanking on it now because we're on the radio.
Me too.
well, ponder it while I remind everybody we're talking canoeing and kayaking today with Darren Bush of Rutabaga Paddle Sports in Madison, and Timothy Bauer. Tim has a book out on canoeing, 60 paddling adventures within 60 miles of Madison, and a forthcoming guidebook covering the Driftless area. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Is it Billings Creek?
I just looked it up.
well done. Yes.
Thank you.
I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We are talking kayaking and canoeing in Wisconsin with our guest, Darren Bush, owner of Rutabaga Paddle Sports in Madison. Timothy Bauer is member of the Milespaddle.com. It's a website for all things paddling in the upper Midwest. It's great to have both of them with us. And again, you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Now, I had another question about summer rivers. You know, which Wisconsin rivers streams do you consider safe to paddle in the summer, maybe as opposed to spring?
A lot of the big rivers are just too burly, have too much water volume, too muddy and tree debris in the springtime. So those would be rivers like the Wisconsin, to some degree, the lower Wisconsin, the lower Black, the lower Chippewa, the lower Wolf. By summertime, they've kind of plateaued, again, with the exception of, you know, high sudden rainfall, that they should be pretty good. And a lot of those, like the lower Black, Chippewa, Wisconsin, they're spectacular sandbar camping prospects. You have your choice of hundreds of islands. You feel like you're doing a backcountry trip, except that everything you could fit in a canoe, up to your cooler and camp chairs and grill if you're so inclined. So it's like having the best of car camping with a primitive feel to it. So those are some of my favorite places to go in the summertime.
Yeah. What about you, Darren?
Pretty much the same. I do love the lower Wisconsin, especially during the weeks, not on the weekends, because oftentimes I'll work on the weekend and then take Tuesday. And I've paddled Wisconsin in the summertime from Spring Green down to, you know, Lone Rock or Muscadet, and not seen a single other person on Tuesday or Wednesday. You go on the Saturday and it's going to be, you know,
busy.
But I mean, I love people. I don't like persons so much. So when I go paddling, I'm trying to usually be alone or with a small group. And the best way to do that is to paddle off work time.
Rex in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Rex.
Okay. First of all, I just wanted to say hello to Darren. And I think he knows me, Rex.
How long ago did you work for me? 15 years, something like that?
I think it's almost 30, maybe.
Holy cow.
But, yeah. And I also wanted to thank Tim for his book, and especially on the subject of bicycle shuttles. Oh. And I do a lot of that, and I think that it's an excellent way to go, get two forms of exercise. You can plant your bicycle one place and your car another place and hop in your boat. As far as a stream that seems to be good for it, that I do maybe once a week almost, is some part of the Sugar River. Uh-huh. almost the whole way from Verona to Broadhead. You can do that sort of thing, and sometimes be on the state bike trail.
Right.
And Broadhead down to the Illinois border actually is gorgeous. It goes through. It's not Avon Bottoms, is it? Avon Bottoms? Yeah, Avon Bottoms.
See, that I know. I don't know Billings Creek, but I know.
But it's a wildlife sanctuary. I don't know if it's a refuge or not, but it's certainly full. Right now, it's great. It's full of birds, and you can see them because there's no leaves.
Yeah.
Right.
Rex, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. So bicycle shuttles, it's a great way to do it.
Well, Tim's book has the best and fastest and ways to do a bike shuttle with the traffic counts being low. In fact, I'm sure that bike shuttle is not something people are familiar with. So, Tim, explain what a bike shuttle is.
We had to tee that up. So I often paddle alone because I try to go to different places, especially if I'm doing some sort of, you know, research or recon on for a guidebook. I don't necessarily want to subject a beloved friend or my partner to something that I myself don't know. So I often paddle by myself. When you're paddling a river, you know, you go in only one direction. And unless you've lost a bet, you're not going to paddle back upstream to where you started. So you have to get back to your starting point. You could arrange a shuttle, maybe, depending on the area of the state you're in and if there is a livery service, but often there isn't, or I'm too frugal to do that. So I drop off a bike, and depending on the direction you're coming from, maybe you do the shuttle first, maybe you do it afterward. But the gist of it essentially is not only are you exercising your legs after sitting in a boat and using, you know, your core and your arms for the last few hours, it's nice to stretch out your legs. You also see the landscape from a completely different vantage point because when you're sitting in a boat and you're on, let's say, a river, the banks are all higher than you, typically, especially if you're in a hillier area. But when you're on the roads, whether that's, you know, driving road, county road, or even a bike trail, you could be as much as, you know, 20 feet higher up than the water you were just on only an hour ago. And I always find it kind of a neat before and after of seeing the landscape from two different perspectives.
That's a really cool
point. The only downside of it, if you're in the Driftless, is I did a bike shuttle on the Grant one time, and I didn't realize that it was straight up and straight down and straight up and straight down. And, but yeah, what I usually do is I'll drop my gear off at the top of the where I put it in, stick it under a bridge or whatever. I've never had anybody take anything usually, right? Drive to the end, drop my truck, ride my bike back to the canoe, lock it up, paddle down to my car, and pick my bike up on the way home. Works quite well.
I feel obliged to have a quick PSA that I have had stuff stolen. The strangest things, from bike lights to a water bottle to an actual cooler with my beverage still in it, still bothers me to this day. So lock your stuff up. This is not to say, like, don't do this at all. Just don't assume always the best, because there are people who are going to take advantage. That said, of the several hundred bike shuttles I've done, I've only had something tampered with like three times. So those odds are pretty good.
So what style of canoe and kayak, is another question, are best for spring paddling, and for, is there a difference between spring and summer?
Well, the best kind of craft is the kind that fits the water you're on. So if you're going to paddle a small twisty turny river, Badfish Creek is just south of here, and it's twisty and turny. You want a shorter, more maneuverable boat, whether it's a canoe or a kayak. If you're going to paddle bigger open lakes, or like Wisconsin River, I consider a lake that moves, right? It's just it's a half a mile wide in lots of places, and it just moves. A flatwater boat, I've paddled sea kayaks on the lower Wisconsin before. So basically, just you tune the boat to where you're paddling, not so much to spring versus summer.
Yeah. No, I totally agree.
Lucas in Jefferson has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Lucas.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm from the Jefferson area, which is my house is a stone's throw away from the Rock River. So I haven't been able to really venture out to there. It's just really me and my dog in my household. So I was wondering if your guests had any ideas or thoughts on including your pets with kayaking. And if there's any like specialized equipment that they know of that can help with that besides training your dog and having it wear like a life vest. Right.
Yeah. Treats. That's special gear.
I got this one. First of all, before I answer the question, I need to ask you a question. Tell me about the goats.
Mm-hmm.
What's with the goat island on the Rock?
Oh, the goat island? Yeah, we have a goat fest, too, here. celebrate the goats. Pretty much just a way to mow the lawn every time, I guess. That's pretty much what I know of.
Yeah, so you're paddling down the Rock River, and you come around the corner, and there's an island full of goats.
Pile of goats.
That's the only place that's ever happened to me. Mm-hmm. Anyway, answering your question. So I have a 100-pound pure Newfie cross. Lucy is, she's big. Because I'm in the fortunate position of knowing people in the industry, I actually asked the folks at North Star Canoe, I said, can I come up and build a boat that's just for me and my dog? And they said, sure. So I took a small tandem and set it up as a solo, where I'm about 2 feet behind the center of the boat, behind the yoke, and then Lucy has the whole front. And so it balances because I'm about 200 pounds. She's about 100 pounds. So she's 4 feet from the center. I'm 2 feet from the center, and you can do the physics. So big is better. It depends on the animal, of course. My lab was, oh, boy, a couple treats, lay down. We're good for a couple hours. Lucy likes to eat milfoil. She likes to jump out and chase geese. But I just love paddling with my pooch. So yeah, a bigger, stabler, a little bit more space. If you try and cram them into a small cockpit, it's not going to go well for anybody.
Yeah, it makes good sense. Timothy, anything to add?
I had a Boston Terrier, pretty much the opposite of Darren's Lucy. and he put up with water to a point. He also put up with reality to a point. But one trick I found is if I could find some kind of public dry land for him to get out of the canoe, walk around, sniff, he was a little less anxious. And so I tried to choose places where I thought, okay, we could reasonably dry dock here for 10 minutes. He could run around for 5 minutes or so, and we'll get back in. And just, I kept the trips really short. I also did mostly lake paddling to avoid the shuttling logistics. I mean, that'll be different if you have two vehicles and it's not just you and your pooch. But if it is just the two of you, you might want to make sure you're paddling somewhere where you don't have a point A to point B type of trip.
I think our dogs are both black and white, and I think that's where it ends.
Yeah, pretty much.
And we had a question. You were talking about one or two people. Actually, it didn't have anything to do with one or two people. It was the advantages and disadvantages and trade-offs between a solo canoe and a kayak.
I love that question.
Well,
Darren,
go ahead and
I could
start.
Probably have an entire show about the solo canoe. I want to tee this off for you. I personally love a solo canoe because it's more comfortable for me. I can sit, I can kneel, I could stretch. I don't feel like I'm just more or less trapped in a which I sometimes do in a kayak. If I have to get in and out of the boat a lot because I'm on a river that no one paddles, and there's a lot of deadfall, it's really easy to get in and out of a canoe. Granted, it's a lot of boat sometimes, and sometimes you don't want to have that much surface area getting stuck on, you know, when there's down trees or whatnot. But I personally find that physically or physiologically, it fits me better, and it kind of just fits my temperament, my personality better.
Yeah. Darren?
Yeah, what he said. I own a dozen canoes, and six of them are solos. So, and that's not counting kayaks, but I don't know how many boats I have. I just have a bunch of boats. It's always a little bit fluid, but I love paddling solo canoes. And an example of what Tim was talking about is like on the Sugar River. You've got banks that are sometimes 3-4 feet higher than the water level. And if you come around the corner and there's a log down, you can maneuver around much easier in a canoe and kind of jump up and grab a handful of grass and haul yourself out. Whereas if you're in a kayak, you've got to figure out how to find a spot that's set up for you to get out of it. It doesn't mean there's not a place for kayaks. It just means for a lot of the water around here, a solo canoe is just a great tool. The other thing is you can use a kayak paddle to paddle a solo canoe. There's no rules against doing that. And so a lot of the canoes that we are selling more and more of are called pack canoes, which is basically a canoe you sit on the bottom of and paddle with a kayak paddle, kind of like a kayak without the top on. Right, but it's easier to get in and out. A lot of folks with mobility issues, knees, you know, ankles, hips, whatever, find it much easier to get in and out of a pack boat than in and out of a kayak.
Makes sense. I want to go to the Driftless area a bit again. It's come up now quite, you know.
Let's always go to the Driftless once. Area.
I think you've talked about what you kind of love about that. About the area, but
there is a history that you can sense with your eyes, your ears, your nose. It has, you know, a very distinctly different look than anywhere else in the state. I used to live in southern New England, so when I first saw the Driftless, I thought, yeah, this is very much like western Massachusetts, the rolling hills. I like topography. I like that it's really, really old. You know, we don't need to dive into the weeds here, but the Driftless area in southwestern Wisconsin is at least 2.5 million years old. It missed all the raising and landscaping, let's call it, of glaciation. And because of that, those river systems are ancient. They're intact. You get a sense of that really up close and personal. The rock formations that line the Driftless area are from, you know, an ancient ocean estimated to be almost 500 million years old. And so when Darren is talking about paddling down the Kickapoo River, you can literally touch, you know, rock that's 500 million years old. And it's sedimentary, it's fissured like a cake. It's just really pretty, especially this time of year. Everything is just coming into bud and burgeoning. The rivers are clean and singing. It's before, I mean, the Driftless area is also surrounded by a lot of farms. And a lot of farms mean runoff from the soil. Occasionally manure spills, it happens. That will tincture the water. But in springtime, it's still really pristine and clean.
And you missed the zero. They're actually, the river system is between 300 and 350 million years old.
Yeah.
It is arguably the oldest river system in the U.S., in North America. There's some dispute about the upper Missouri, but other than that, but it is, it's old. And one of the things I like about the bluffs is the plants that grow on it, because it's a lot of spring water that infuses itself through that sandstone. And if you just paddle up to it and stick your nose against it and breathe, it's a sensory experience.
Sure.
I always do that one. So, but are you kissing that wall? I said, no, I'm just breathing in 300 million year old stone and plant.
As one does.
As one does.
What's going to be in your new book?
Oh,
on
boy.
The Driftless?
Gosh. Well, I hope we can talk about that, you know, next year or so when it comes out. But I wanted to treat the entire Driftless area in one contained singular book. And so there's a little bit of controversy about whether we should even use the word Driftless for neighboring states, Iowa and Minnesota. But to me, you still call that Driftless because it wasn't affected by the glaciers of the last ice age. Were they glaciated a couple of million years ago? Yes. Does it look like the corresponding sides in southwestern Wisconsin and northwestern Illinois? Yes. So to me, it's all Driftless. There are about 30-ish rivers I spent a lot of time thinking about what to include and what not to include. But there's everything from tricky trout streams that will have water, enough water to paddle for only about 24 hours, to, and that are only about 20 feet wide, to, you know, rivers that are about 500 feet wide and will almost always have enough water. Really slow rivers, fast rivers with class 1-2 rapids, everything in between.
Tom in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon to all of you. Thanks for this excellent program. My wife and I do our fair share of paddling. We do the Nina Creek. We do Fox. We do crawfish stuff kind of around that Columbus, Marquette, Columbia County area for the most part. But we do stray. But we have noticed that as our experience has grown with every mile, our capabilities have changed because of our age. And we shifted from a really fast Winona that we had to a little bit wider boat and a little bit more stable. And that kind of had to do with us, you know. And I'm just wondering if there's anything as we age and you know, prosthetic knees and hips and stuff come in to play for many of us. Is there one that's better than the other, or, you know, it's all personal comfort and such, but yeah, we love it. And again, we realize that our balance isn't what it used to be. So yeah. We switched.
Last one off the water wins. So yeah, I used to race canoes, and then my race partner went away to medical school, and I'm like, I don't want to break another one in, because it's a fairly intimate thing. You get a rhythm with your race partner. And then I'm like, I don't like going fast anymore. I mean, I'm 63. I'm very happy to just go a little bit slower. And with rivers, it doesn't matter anyway, right? You've got now a mile or 2 mile an hour current to push you along. But yeah, I have boats that are a little bit less stable than some. I don't call them unstable. I call them a little tender. You have to be a little more careful with them. But I don't paddle them on the sugar in the winter. I'll take my more stable boats and paddle those. So the best boat is the one that gets wet the most. Yeah. So you've done a good thing by switching to something that gives you a little bit more stability and comfort.
Yeah, and Tom, and I think you're just being sensible and honest with, you know, where you and, you know, your partner are at. You still go to the rivers. You know how they're going to be. You would be kind of dishonest to yourself if you forced it or whatnot. But you're going with what's comfortable for you, what's the best paddling for you, but you're returning to the rivers that you love. And I think that's the exact right way to go about it.
Yeah, makes good sense. And Stephanie in Madison has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. I'm wondering about inflatable kayaks in Wisconsin. I've used one in Colorado, and I really appreciate how gentle they are when you run into something. But I wonder if they transfer to our Wisconsin environment well.
They do. And when he first said Stephanie from Madison, I'm like, why is my wife calling me?
That's what I was thinking. Is this being set up?
Yeah. When are you coming home from work? yeah, they work great. And inflatables aren't what people think they are. They used to think of them as sort of big beach toys that kind of look like what people think a canoe looks like, but it isn't. They've gone to a different technology. The bottoms of them often use what's called the drop stitch, which basically gives you the ability to make a big, flat, 15 PSI board. It's like a right. basketball, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they paddle more like hard shell boats. But the other thing is pack boats. They're becoming a thing as well. And we've got a pack boat that we sell. It's 20 pounds. So you can take that and put it on the back of your bike and paddle to the river, or pedal to the river, inflate it, paddle down, and paddle back up again, or pedal back up again. So if you've got an e-bike and a small inflatable, the world is your oyster, right? And they're also they're usually a bit less expensive than a hard shell boat, and you know, there's some compromises with performance, but on a river, who cares? And to that point about performance, a friend of mine went out for a paddle, for a 2-hour paddle in his fast boat. Then he went for a 2-hour paddle in his slower boat. And the difference in the time it took him to do the same course was 5 minutes.
Wow.
So if you go to the Boundary Waters and, oh, I'm going to get a fast boat, I'm going to go. It's like, yeah, let them, right? You'll get there 10 minutes later and they'll have dinner going. So, yeah, just take it easy. Last one off the water wins, right?
It's like driving in that regard too. You could drive 10 miles per hour over the speed limit, just cruise through red lights. You're only going to get home like 3 minutes faster. Yeah, meanwhile, yeah. You've done all this public safety issues. Yeah. The thing I'd say about inflatables, in addition to everything Darren just laid out, you don't have to worry about a roof rack. You don't have to worry about a trailer. It folds up really small in a compartmentalized size that fits in the back of your car. There's no wind resistance. It's really easy. You don't have to worry about your shoulders, getting a boat on and off the car, straps, etc., wind. That's a real advantage to be able to just do that, get in and out. That's true whether you're going only 30 minutes from your house or 3,000 miles.
I think our number one demographic of purchasing those are people in campers or RVs. Because they want to paddle too, but try and get a canoe on top of a big old Airstream. Good luck.
Darren Bush and Tim Bauer, our guests today, as we talk paddling with them. And I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to WPR News. Talking with Darren Bush of Rutabaga Paddle Sports in Madison, Timothy Bauer, Tim, member of MilesPaddle.com, a website, and he's authored a wonderful book on canoeing and kayaking in South Central Wisconsin as well. He's got another book that'll be coming out on the Driftless area. Great to have him with us. George in Madison has a question or comment, I believe. George, hi.
Hi. Thank you, gentlemen, for talking today. I'm a senior citizen who does a lot of canoeing and short canoes on twisty rivers like the Badfish Creek and the Mekan River. Mm-hmm. And I've been disappointed to see the extent to which some other enthusiasts have cleared out some of the obstacles in these streams.
Yeah.
Is there some kind of ethic or guidance on the extent to which people should do that?
Yeah.
I don't know if there is a hard and fast rule, George. I think a lot of it's subjective, and a lot of it's going to be prone to safety. I think I'm going to get a little bit out of my lane here and say, like, I know for some fishing folks and ecologists, having deadfall in the water is good for habitat. I don't disagree one iota. But if I'm coming upon a twist on either the Badfish or Mekan, and full disclosure, I have sawed lots of limbs on both streams, I do so only with a minimalist approach to allow the narrowest passage that will be safe for paddlers, because I know someone's going to be behind me, either literally, part of me that day, or the next day, the next week, the next month. And I care more, frankly, about a recreational paddler and their safety by snapping off or cutting off one or two limbs. I keep everything else intact, but that I'm guilty of that, and I frankly will stand by that, because I've seen too many people get stuck in trees and go through total panic attacks, rightfully so, and have not been back inside a boat because of that.
I'm on the same page. I usually carry a bow saw with me, and mostly in the spring. Usually outfitters will keep things pretty clean, but like the Upper Sugar, I don't think I saw a single downed tree that wasn't at least modified a little bit. Yeah. So they'll cut out, I'll cut out like a 3 or 4 foot swath, right, where people can kind of get their boats through there. But I fully agree that leaving the rest of it in the river for fish habitat or just frankly for aesthetics, I don't like things to be clean.
Right.
Right.
And part of it is the fun, the challenge of navigating, negotiating space, how to get around something. Do you go under it, over it, left, right, etc.? I want to keep that as intact for people as possible. And I think there is a reasonable compromise between that negotiation and public safety.
Before we close out for sure, I wanted to mention the 60th anniversary of the Wild Rivers Act. and a guy by the name of Dave Martin. Tim, you want to?
Yeah, be happy. Thank you for the opportunity. A lot of this, frankly, I myself have learned only in the last couple of months, thanks to the River Alliance of Wisconsin, reminding all of us that year 2025 marks the 60th anniversary of, frankly, benchmark legislation done in 1965. It started with the Pine, Popple, and Pike Rivers in the very northeastern nook of the state. And essentially what it means is development is prevented along those rivers, or at least certain corridors of the rivers, not the entire river lengths themselves. And what this does, in effect, is preserve the rivers then so that in 1965 they could look like what they looked like earlier in the 20th century. And today, 60 years later, they still look like what they looked like in 1965. That legislation in the state, which I think is also worth noting, was passed unanimously. It was bipartisan. And that is unheard of in today's contentious world of politics. But this, everyone, Republican, Democrat, was on board with this in 1965.
And Dave Martin was a Republican.
He was a Republican and was signed into law by Republican Gaylord Nelson at the time.
Do you know Fred Madison? Remember him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dr. Dirt, who he passed away a couple of years ago. He was sitting in the office with Lyndon Johnson when they put this together. See, he was one of the original guys that did this, and he's from Madison. So
yeah, and right. So to Darren's point, 3 years later on the federal level, Congress passed the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act in 1968, which also protected the St. Croix, Namekagon, and the Wolf Rivers here in Wisconsin. But it started off as a homegrown thing.
So did Earth Day.
Yeah, right? So did Earth Day, also signed into law by the same Gaylord Nelson.
And I think it was March 7th, Dave Martin passed away at the age of...
He was, I think, like 93.
93 years old.
Yeah. I know.
He had an amazing life and kind of an amazing guy.
He's certainly an inspiration because it's a good example too that today we're often surrounded by, we're tagged. You're an environmentalist, but you could be a conservationist and be within conservation is to conserve. You could be a conservative who still cares about wildlife, wild places, and in this case, wild rivers.
A couple of other questions. Somebody was wondering about the maneuverability of the inflatable.
They're usually quite maneuverable. They're sort of designed that way. The pack boats I'm talking about are very popular out west. So you'll see guys in Colorado that will hike up to a little stream and then they'll fish it, and then they'll hike back down again with their 17-pound boat. But yeah, there it's all related to length and the shape of the bottom and all that. But some of them do have a little skeg, a little fin. You can insert it to make them track a little bit straighter if you're going on open water, and then pull it off when you get to the river.
And somebody else, and we're just about out of time, but wondering if you're interested in paddling streams, is there anything different from paddling down a river in a stream?
No.
Scale.
Yeah. I mean, with the gradient, how fast it's flowing, and also the countryside. Are you in farmland? Are you in a forest? Very different experiences.
So it's six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Yeah. I mean, the more remote place you are, you're going to be limited to how many accesses there are in dry land, like how many bridges there are. So that might affect, exactly where you're going. But to my recognition, there is no difference between a river and a creek. there are plenty, like Turtle Creek is called a creek, and it's
not a creek.
Almost 300 feet wide in places. So
where I come from, it's called a crick.
A crick, right. Yeah.
Darren Bush and Tim Bauer, our guests today. Darren, owner of Rutabaga Paddle Sports. Timothy Bauer, member of milespaddle.com. Take a look at that website as well for all things paddling in the upper Midwest. Great to have them with us. And always great to have the team that we've got, Joel Patnaud and Clara Neipert, our producers. Technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. And Rutabaga Paddle Sports, by the way, is one of our many business sponsors. Great to have them as well.